Hi, my name is Warner Lewis. Thank you for joining me for Creating Home, a weekly podcast exploring what different successful individuals have done to allow them to find their physical, emotional, and spiritual home. We'll discuss their individual journeys, including disadvantages, roadblocks, adversity, and dead ends, as well as their strategies, successes, and support, which allowed them to overcome obstacles and thrive. When I first thought of creating a real estate-focused podcast, it quickly expanded beyond chatting with past clients and friends about their real estate. While real estate provides my financial livelihood as a New York City real estate broker helping clients purchase and sell their homes for the past 15 years, my passion for it derives from expanding my life through the close relationships that are created during the process of finding a home. Indeed, a home to me is so much more than the physical walls in which we live, but it is also the actions we take to ground ourselves and find peace and acceptance, as well as the people with whom we surround ourselves and who give support and guidance. As we find ourselves spending more time at home these days, I have reflected on my own journey that started with the choice to go into this industry 16 years ago. At that time, I was basically unemployable, alone, deeply depressed, and truly felt that real estate was the last option I had and had avoided because if this didn't work, I felt I was out of options. The act of going into real estate and metaphorically burning the boats behind me and being all in on changing my life has led me to the place where I am today. I have an incredible business partner, Ari Harkove, and we have had one of the top 200 real estate sales teams in the nation for the past 5 years. I have a loving and deeply accommodating wife and two wonderful and exhausting kids and more true friendships than I ever dared hope for when I was a socially awkward and terrified kid. The hope is that in hearing what these intrepid individuals have gone through to get where they are today will be inspiring to others on their journey to find home and a sense of physical safety, emotional peace, and individual success in the sometimes raging storm of life. If that happens, then the goal of this podcast will have been met. Today on our inaugural journey, I am very happy to have someone who I've known for 30 years and have seen undergo one of the most remarkable transformations of anyone I've ever witnessed. Top Chef star and now James Beard Award nominee, Chef Gregory Gourdet. Gregory, thank you so much for joining me and doing this with me and for being there for 30 years. It's been incredible to watch you. And you have been an inspiration and just an amazing presence in my life. And I'm so glad to have made the choice all those years ago to go to St. Andrews and meet you at a boarding school in Delaware and still be in touch 30 years later. So, you know, the thought process behind this and your journey has been, you know, pretty remarkable from being in New York City to being where you are today. And first, I'd love just to sort of, if you could take us through your apartment and where you're recording this from. And obviously, home today is a little bit different than it was 30, 40, 60 days ago. So I'd love just to, you know, hear where you live, what your apartment's like, and what sense of sort of calm and comfort you've created in your home.
Sure, of course. Well, it's great to talk. And I can't believe it's been almost 30 years. That's been quite a ride for sure. We've seen each other through a lot. But yeah, but thanks for having me. I'm really excited for this. This is a great concept and I'm really looking forward to our talk today. But currently I am in Portland, Oregon in the Pacific Northwest. It's a beautiful sunny day. I have a little 2-bedroom bachelor pad right just 1 mile off of downtown Portland. We are known as Bridge City, among another a lot of different other names for our town, Rose City. But there are about 7 different bridges in town, and I live just right across the Burnside Bridge. It's a pretty iconic bridge for the city, and it's called Southeast Industrial. It's a developing neighborhood. It was mostly factories and workshops back in the day, and it's developing as everywhere does. But it's right off of downtown. It's in a good intersection where all our different quadrants meet. So it's extremely convenient considering I work just a mile away. So my apartment, being that we are in the Pacific Northwest and it rains quite a bit, we basically live in a rainforest. I was inspired by my Caribbean Haitian heritage. So my apartment is actually painted 7 colors from four shades of Caribbean blues. I have a wall painted gold that my painter was really upset about because gold takes about 8 coats to put on. And some emerald, some splashes of pink, and it's just me and my 130 houseplants. So keeping it nice and cozy and tropical in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. With you, there's so many fascinating things. I think that, you know, the first thing that I'd love to delve into is how you've got to where you are today, i.e. starting from being in New York and then the circuitous journey to where you are today. Because I know we're both native New Yorkers, both taking a lot of pride in being that. And we even have discussed in the past an acceptance that you had that maybe New York wasn't the best place for you and what Portland has allowed to come into your life.
Absolutely. You know, my parents immigrated here in the late 60s to pursue education and start a family. They moved here from Haiti. They're in their early 20s, mid-20s, and I was born 5 years later. They were married. But I grew up, you know, in Queens, Laurelton, Queens, which is by Jamaica. And my parents just always kind of wanted the best for me. You know, we didn't grow up in like the worst neighborhood by any means, but, you know, they always knew that there was something better out there. And we actually grew up in a great neighborhood filled with, you know, like Caribbeans and strong Haitian community. So all that was really awesome. And, you know, our relatives would just always come visit us from Haiti. So there's always lots of people over and there's always a big sense of family. But, you know, when it came time to go to high school, after going to a Catholic school in Queens for grade school, my parents, you know, offered me the opportunity to either, you know, go to private school in the city or to go to boarding school. And I use a program called Prep for Prep, which is a program which prepares, you know, kids in urban neighborhoods and kids of color to get them ready to apply to private schools in the city and boarding schools around the East Coast. So I ended up going to St. Andrews, actually. And I think really that's where we met, obviously. But I think it truly was that experience that kind of opened my eyes to meeting different types of people. You know, I grew up in a very African-American, Caribbean-American, Haitian-American neighborhood. So, you know, it was my first time hanging out with, like, a lot of white people from different parts of New York and, like, the Upper East Side, different parts of the country. So I think in that respect, you know, I'm really grateful because I feel a lot of New Yorkers, obviously, they'd never leave New York. And I think if I hadn't left if I hadn't gone to St. Andrews, I'd probably be one of those New Yorkers who had never left New York. But St. Andrews was an amazing opportunity. You know, I think it really instilled in me a sense of, you know, wanting to be outside and appreciation of nature. And, you know, conservation and the environment are still things that are extremely important to me till this day. And I think, you know, being in a natural surrounding, since our school was, you know, this beautiful setting, cornfields and this huge pond. You know, I think that kind of was such a stark difference from growing up in Queens that it really put something in me. So fast forward to first year of college at NYU when I was trying to be a doctor and studying pre-med. But, you know, going back to the city after 4 years in Delaware did not seem exciting to me. I kind of had a hard time kind of adjusting back to city life, and, you know, commuting 2 hours from Queens from my parents' house. So I looked out west, and I actually ended up going to the University of Montana to study wildlife biology. And it was out there that I had to start cooking for myself. It was a really, really big difference, a really big change of pace. But I was, you know, after going to a really, really small boarding school in Delaware, you know, living in Montana was not that big of a difference. You know, people often ask me where I went to college, and I tell them University of Montana, and I tell them I'm from Queens. And they're always wondering how the hell I got out there. But, you know, it made sense and it was fun. You know, it was a great liberal arts college. And, you know, I was living on my own for the first time, you know, renting my own house. And there was just lots of people my age and we were all like creative and we were all inspired. You know, I was in the dance department. I hung out with artists. You know, we threw raves. It was great, you know, and I met lots of different people from that part of the world. And, you know, small town America life. And, you know, that kind of opened my eyes to some new things I had never seen before. Recreational drugs are definitely a big part of that. You know, we would throw all night raves and that was a big part of it as well. So I've kind of, you know, had this thing for the West. Fast forward to, you know, going back to New York City and, you know, 2 years at the Culinary Institute of America upstate, and then, you know, 7 years in New York City, and a quickly developing drug addiction for a lot of that. You know, towards the end of that, I had an opportunity to move back out West, and I did. And I moved to San Diego for a year to work for some friends before finally landing a job in Portland, Oregon, where I've been for the past 13 years. And Portland has definitely changed my life 100%. And I don't think if you'd asked me when I was younger, or even, you know, years before moving out West, if I ever saw myself kind of being bi-coastal and living in the Pacific Northwest, I probably wouldn't have said so. But Portland has been absolutely amazing. I had a huge life transformation here. I got sober here. You know, so many amazing things have happened to my career here. You know, and I think for, as a chef, Portland is definitely an amazing culinary destination. We have so many amazing farms. We grow food year round. Produce and products are top notch, and the chef community here is really strong. So all in all, it just worked out to be the perfect thing at the perfect time.
So Gregory, you know, having known you for so long and seeing where you are today, and remembering the New York City moments very vividly because, you know, I was party to a lot of them. I remember a Gregory that is so far removed from the Gregory that everyone sees on Top Chef today, and hearing what you were doing from trail running to writing a book to feeding the homeless during this pandemic to looking to open a restaurant to being on television, it's hard to envision from the Gregory that I remember. Once even calling, literally just having to get out of New York City, having not slept for days, and coming up to where I was for a weekend just for literally just to kind of run away. You know, were there any seminal moments that really were big changes for you? You know, what really was it, if there is any one specific thing or maybe a series of things that helped the change occur in you that allowed you to get to where you are today on this incredible journey that, you know, now millions of people are watching you undertake?
I think for me, it was a lot of influences. And I don't think it was necessarily one moment, but I mean, honestly, you know, I had an amazing family. I do have an amazing family. I grew up in a loving home. I grew up with parents who worked two jobs their entire careers. You know, they gave us everything that they could. You know, they only wanted the best for us. They were super understanding, even though, you know, my sister and I grew up extremely different than how they grew up. You know, like when my father grew up, you know, he didn't have running water or electricity, you know, when he was a kid. The town still barely does, you know. So I grew up in, you know, New York City, you know, during the 90s, you know. So we grew up extremely different. But I've just always had them as role models. You know, I've always had, you know, our group of friends, you know, that we all bonded in high school, you know, as examples of, you know, just normal American life. You know, working at Jean Georges, you know, literally the first real professional kitchen I worked in, you know, awarded 3 Michelin stars, 4 stars by New York Times, you know, when that rating was still there, you know. So I've always had these images of excellence in my head. You know, my problem was, you know, I just have an addictive personality and I developed a really bad drug addiction. And the thing with drug addiction is, you know, it can be hereditary. Like you can, if there's a pretty much a 50% percentage if your parents are addicts or alcoholics that you will become an addict or an alcoholic, or you can make yourself an addict or an alcoholic through repetitive use of drugs and alcohol. And it's literally a brain disease. And it's something that I gave myself through, you know, the 7 years of constant drug addiction, you know, like starting in high school, recreational drugs, you know, we used to party, you know, that, you know, but I mean, I was eating acid, but like by the time I was like 16, you know, eating mushrooms by the time I was like 16, 17. Fast forward to, you know, my early 20s in Montana, and I'm, you know, ecstasy, you know, ketamine, doing meth with people in Montana. You know, it was a long, long history of drug use. And, you know, by the time I was in my late 20s and living in New York City, you know, New York City, which is open till 4 a.m., you know, and that's just when the bars close. You know, there's still after hours and after hours, and always someone who's willing to stay up. You know, so it was quite a long, long chunk of my life that was filled with drug use, and then finally, you know, very, very bad drug abuse. You know, but the whole time, I was kind of in it by myself. You know, like, I chose to hang out with people who did a lot of drugs, and granted, we all did recreational drugs, and a lot of us were fine, you know, but after everyone went to bed, you know, I would just hang out with shadier and shadier people, you know? So, you know, I think for me, it just became an issue that stemmed from my personality, because I only had really great examples of, you know, how to be and people who love me in my life. So, you know, I think with some maturity and realizing that I was, you know, by the time I moved to Portland, you know, and I was on like, you know, job number, what, 4 or 5 in like a year and a half, 2 year span, you know, after, you know, having worked at Jean Georges for almost 7 years, you know, having moved to 3 states within 1 year, you know, I realized that I was just done, you know, and I finally was able to catch myself in a pattern. And I physically realized that I could physically no longer drink or smoke because it just made me feel like just fucking shit, you know? And the thing is, why Portland is so special to me, and why I always call Portland, Oregon home, is because, you know, I moved here to work in my current job at Departure, but things didn't really work out as well as they're supposed to. And I ended up working at this really, really old small cafe named Saucebox for the first year and a half that I was in Portland. And the first day I walked into that restaurant, I met my sous chef. He's going to be under me. His name was Tommy. And he told me that he was 2 years sober. He hadn't drank in 2 years. And that was literally the first time I had ever met someone who hadn't drank in 2 years. And to me, it was unfathomable that you could go 2 years without drinking. And I hung out with him and his group of sober chef friends, and we would hang out, we would smoke cigarettes, we would like work out. And then after that, I would immediately go to the bar and get drunk or do coke and stay up for quite some time. And after a few months of this pattern, you know, and me realizing that I was ready to make a change in my life, I asked Tom to take me to an AA meeting. I thought about it good and long, and I really asked myself if I really thought I was ready to stop doing drugs and stop drinking and stop smoking cigarettes for the rest of my life. And I told myself, yes, I was. I completely felt extremely ready just to be done. And Tom was in AA, and I asked him to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was, you know, almost 11 and a half years ago. You know, I think when I was ready, I was just ready, you know, and a lot of people struggle in early recovery. A lot of people, you know, have desires to drink. You know, a lot of people keep smoking because it's like one less thing they have to give up, you know. But for me, I was all that energy that I had spent, you know, just staying up and, you know, doing drinking and doing the drugs, you know, and I used all that energy just to get as healthy as possible and just to focus on my career, you know, and I immediately started training for my first marathon, and, you know, I went paleo, and I completely changed how I eat. I stopped eating gluten. I stopped eating dairy. I lost like 30 pounds and I was just ready. And I think it was just having, you know, a good upbringing and examples of excellence, you know, be it through my parents or be it through my peers or be it through my employer, for so long that even though I was on drugs, I was still paying attention, you know, and I still was very aware of what I had. And you know, I finally reached a point where I was ready to kind of go and kind of create my own destiny and fight for the things that I thought were important to me. And, you know, I think the power of, you know, a loving home is extremely important. The power of, you know, parents that stay together is extremely important. The power of a family who is supportive no matter what, you know, is really important. And just having amazing examples of who I wanted to be, you know, throughout my life. When it was time to be that person, you know, it was very easy for me to become that person.
I'm guessing you somewhat already answered this, but I'm guessing even with that, there were some moments that you were just like, oh God, like this, I'm here again. I have this feeling that I don't like. And when, or if those feelings come up, I mean, I'm obviously doing uncomfortable things bring up emotions. I'm imagining that the first time you were shooting for Top Chef, or the first time you were giving a talk, you get uncomfortable. And when you get uncomfortable, people usually go into routines, good or bad. What, if anything, have you done when those things arose or arise still that help you sort of get through what could be, you know, a pothole?
Yeah, I mean, I think in recovery, they have this thing called the pink cloud, and it's where you're just stoked. You know, life is just so fantastic because the weight of, you know, all the pangs of your addiction and all those things have been lifted. You know, I also worked through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and that's the full 12 steps of, you know, admitting that you're an addict and an alcoholic, admitting you have a problem, admitting you're helpless over alcohol, you know, taking a moral inventory of all the good things and all the bad things that you've done throughout your life, you know, making amends to people, be it physically, you know, calling people and not necessarily apologizing for what you did to them, or more so just talking about the fact that you weren't the best person, you know, and it's not for you. It's, you know, it's not, hey man, I'm sorry I did that. You know, that's not what it's supposed to be. It's just about you, honoring, you know, some of the bad things that you did to, you know, test your relationship with others and just letting them know that you are aware of it, you know, and sometimes you call them, sometimes you email them, sometimes you talk to them in person. And there's also a thing called living amends where it's, you just choose to live a better life moving forward. You just choose to be a better person for that person. And it's a living amends. So kind of like you try to make up the past with the present and the future. So there's that. So, you know, I feel like I went through a lot, and it was a very emotional process going through my amends, and, you know, flying to different states to talk to people that, you know, I used to work with and who were really close friends of mine, and just being like, you know, and I'm really sorry I acted the way I did when, you know, we're in New York, and reaching out to old employers and, you know, and me still having some guilt around some things I did with my family and just trying to be a really better person today. So that's one of the things that keeps driving me. But I feel extremely lucky that, you know, I've never really had the darkest day. I've had some challenging times in recovery for sure. But I know that whatever I go through now and anything I've gone through in the past 12 years, 11 and a half years, you know, is far easier than anything I would have had to go through, you know, if I was still trying to recover from drugs and alcohol addiction, you know? So I feel very lucky, you know, and that's just the perspective that I keep, that, you know, life is going to happen no matter what. If I'm drinking or not, you know, life is going to happen. But the thing is, like, by not drinking and by not doing drugs, I can approach a situation in a sober and thoughtful way. I can have some emotional stability, emotional strength, emotional clarity, and face these challenges. And then I know I'll get through it.
So I think you just really nailed, you know, the sort of the crux of what I'm trying to get to and to learn different people and how they go through it. And you said something that I love, which life is going to happen no matter what. And to me, that, you know, it really sort of rings and speaks of acceptance, just mm-hmm. that life is going to happen and it's how you're going to show up for it. And quite honestly, a willingness to show up. I know for myself, even doing this podcast is something that there's a part of me that has nerves around putting myself out there. And on the same time, I know now that the things that make me nervous that I'm excited about are the things I need to do. And that life, a lot of life, is a choice of showing up and how you're going to show up. Are you going to show up and be accepting of whatever outcome there is, or try to control it? And at least for me, controlling and in the past a lot was sabotage. Easiest way to control something is to blow it up. And it's interesting, you know, you're talking about going through AA. I didn't have that experience, but before my son was born, I knew that life was going to be very different. And I went and met with a Buddhist monk to start meditating. And what he said to me was that the certain cycles that I have in my mind are never going to change. And he actually likened it to having certain channels on the television. You're always going to have those channels. But the key, he said, was adding new channels. So if you have four channels and two of them are filled with anxiety and distress, if you can add 10 channels, then all of a sudden you're, instead of being one out of two, it's one out of six. And it's a lot easier to deal with. And you did that by taking the addictive personality and taking your energy and putting it towards things that are self-esteem building instead of destructive and sabotaging. You know, that's incredibly inspiring. And I don't think that anyone who can see you today can fully grasp and understand, because I still have, you know, the memories of you being a baseball team manager. And it's laughable to me now that the most athletic of anyone and everyone who was in our class at St. Andrews was someone who at the time was the least interested in being athletic. And that is pure drive and determination, and something that is inside of you that you unlocked. And obviously you pointed to your family and having met your parents multiple times and being a parent now and knowing how impactful parents can be. And just, it's kind of amazing to me to know what your parents must have felt and gone through for a few years with you, and for them to never waver is amazing. I hope that if a situation like that ever comes up with my kids, I can be as strong as they are. And I do, the one thing I feel very lucky that I do have wonderful kids who are sweet and loving, and that's, you know, a characteristic in you that has always shown through, and that that's Gigi, even though now it's Gregory. But you know, I think we've touched on a lot, but if there was any sort of crystallization that you could put out there for where you really feel at home, and not maybe in your apartment, even though obviously now that's where everyone is spending a lot of their time, but where for you is the place you feel most free and most at one with yourself and at peace? And there aren't, I don't know if your head is a Gatling gun of thoughts, which mine is, but where are you most at peace? Where do you find home? Where have you created that sanctuary?
For me, you know, I think I started running, you know, as a part of my recovery. You know, I've run numerous marathons. I've done a couple of 50-mile races. I actually signed up for a 100-mile race one year, but we got canceled because of the weather. But, you know, my relationship with running is, I actually started running when I was in rehab in New York City, and there's nothing for me to do. I moved back into my parents' house. I was going to rehab in Union Square. It was outpatient. And I would just run this little 2-mile loop around my parents' house in Douglaston, Queens. And it was awful. It was really awful. It was extremely painful. And it was like my first time really running, but I had nothing else to do. So it became very full circle, you know, for me to run my first marathon, you know, during my first year of recovery. But living in Oregon, we're surrounded by woods, and you know, I definitely feel like my running career has peaked, but it's definitely something I still do. But being alone in the woods is probably my safest place, you know, and just being out there running far, you know, being extremely tired and just having the peace and the quiet and the solace of just being at one with nature, that's like extremely important to me. You know, I spent a lot of times running, just kind of fixing things in my head and just clearing my head and pushing myself physically. And running has just been such a big part of my recovery. So I think that's someplace I feel extremely safe. And honestly, the exact opposite of that is, you know, is probably like on a dance floor, like at a huge festival in Europe. You know, and part of what got me into this sticky situation is my love of music and my love of dance and club culture. You know, you were there as well. And mm-hmm. that's just something that went hand in hand with drugs and alcohol and staying up late for quite some time. And it actually took me quite a few years to separate that, you know. So when I got sober, you know, I didn't go out for years, you know, and the first time I went to a festival or first time I went to a club in New York City, you know, I drank like probably like 12 to 15 Red Bulls just because I didn't know what to do with my hands. And, you know, I just had that feeling of anxiety and, you know, like I have to consume something, you know, and I've gone through the Red Bull stage for sure because it's awful. But
oh, terrible. Oh, just the worst. Yeah.
But it did take some time for me to separate that, you know, and one thing that's really important to me is, you know, I truly feel that I got sober to just live my life, live the life that I've always wanted to live. And I don't let, you know, my disease get in the way of that, you know. So, you know, I don't go to bars, but, you know, I'm not scared of bars. And, you know, a lot of people often question, you know, how I can, you know, go to festivals and stay up for like, you know, to like 10 in the morning still, you know, for like the sunrise set or like, be on, you know, on a cruise that's a festival for like 3 days. But, you know, that's just something that I've always enjoyed doing. And I love the music. And, you know, honestly, a lot of DJs are sober these days because we're all older. So that's just one element of something that I enjoy doing that is a lot safer and a lot more enjoyable now that I'm sober. So like being like in a festival and crowds of thousands of people, you know, by myself dancing, you know, sober, is actually pure bliss for me, you know? So, it's two opposite ends of the spectrum, but you know, those are both parts of my personality and they're both important to me.
Yeah, no, it's really funny for me. There are few things that I catch myself on where I know I'm happy and in a good place. And one without a doubt is when I'm able to listen to music and really be touched in one way or the other or excited by it. And usually that entails me sending you whatever I'm listening to.
Yeah.
And I love getting it back from you. But there is, for me, the three things: music, reading, and being able to immerse myself in a show of some kind. Are three tells for me that I'm in a good headspace. But music is actually, funnily enough, one of the biggest ones. If I'm not listening to music, I know I'm not in a good place. And I it's funny looking back at how enjoyable some of the instances that we did share being, what's the Green Velvet, Bad Little Kids Doing Bad Little Things were. But I wouldn't trade those for being able to go to sleep with a clear conscience. And even for me, even being in bed sometimes at 9:30 with a book is pure bliss in heaven for me with a clear conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And Gregory, what are you working on right now?
So yeah, I'm working on a few different projects. I'm currently finishing my manuscript for my first cookbook. It's entitled Everyone's Table, Global Flavors for Modern Health. It's a health-focused cookbook. It focuses on the top 100 superfoods. And basically, it's inspired by all my travels around the world in search of flavors, all the different ethnicities and different cultures that I've been able to experience culinary-wise throughout my career, and obviously tapping into a lot of my Haitian heritage. You know, when I got sober, I changed my diet completely. I went dairy and gluten-free. And I just kind of been able to have all these amazing flavors and these amazing tastes and come up with all these dishes that were kind of really, really health focused, but I was able to kind of sneak them into our work at the restaurant. So they just became this kind of this style of cuisine that is super good for you. It's not missing any flavors because it focuses on so many of these amazing, beautiful global flavors, from ingredients like fish sauce to Korean chili flakes to, you know, Scotch bonnet chilies. And it's full flavored, super healthy food featuring the top 100 superfoods and just kind of missing all the stuff that isn't necessarily 100% good for you. So that is slated to come out next May. So I'm extremely excited for that. That's going to be really fantastic. Currently, I am also in the works of trying to open my own restaurant, which was a goal for early of next year. But with the pandemic and with everything going on in American restaurants right now, I'm taking a little bit more time to kind of see what happens with our landscape and kind of push back on that a little bit, but definitely hoping to open my own restaurant finally in 2021, hopefully mid-year, hopefully as we're closer to a vaccine for COVID. But, you know, American restaurants are, you know, pretty much about 80% of American restaurants are closed right now, which is pretty grave. That 20% that's open, you know, really to go model, a takeout model. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a pretty big percentage of restaurants that won't reopen. Everyday restaurants are closing permanently because, you know, the restaurants are, you know, profit margins are slim in a restaurant, and a lot of people open restaurants out of passion, you know, desire to be of service, to serve others, you know. So margins are slim. So, you know, it's a really critical time for American restaurants with COVID closing everything down. And, you know, it's tough. You know, the restaurants that can figure it out, that have resources, that were able to get loans from the government and took them, you know, they have a fighting chance. But, you know, every day I'm hearing about, you know, smaller restaurants that are closing forever. And unfortunately, you know, as much as I try to be tuned in, you know, I'm hearing about, you know, restaurants that I've probably never heard of before. And that's unfortunate, you know, but there's a lot of smaller, you know, small old communities, places that are closing forever.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a very tough and very sad landscape. You know, you look at a lot of business models and restaurants being one of them. Now it seems insane to have 2 months of cash on hand for a business, uh-huh. But no one expected a complete and utter pandemic shutdown. And that's how black swan events happen. So with the restaurant world, it's going to be very interesting. The good thing is there are so many smart, talented people that I know there is going to be something that's going to come out of this that's going to be great, and that you are going to do something spectacular yourself, and others will. I hope for as little pain as possible, but sadly the trickle down from the front of house to the chef to the busboy to the dishwasher, there's just a whole lot of people who are going to be hurting. So, you know, I know you've been doing a lot of good for your community, and I just hope that everyone out there can just try to do little nice things on a daily basis for those who are less fortunate, because there are a lot of people whose names we don't know who are behind the scenes, who, Greg, I know you know in your restaurants, who just don't really have fallback options. And so human kindness is going to go a long way to get us through this. And you know, if you have the ability to, in any way, shape, or form, give to those who are hurting, you know, please do. And are there any in particular not-for-profits or GoFundMes or anything that you are giving to or know of that you really want to champion here and now?
Yeah, so there's the Independent Restaurant Coalition. It's a national group that formed when the pandemic hit, IRC, and it's saverestaurants.com. And it's a really great site talking about just what exactly is going on in restaurants, what we need to reopen, and you know what we're doing to communicate with Congress, to communicate with the government on a daily basis. It's kind of a place where you can go one click, sign petitions, kind of raising alarm to Congress. So I definitely suggest everyone go there, saverestaurants.com, and it's a great resource. Founded by a lot of leading figures, Tom Colicchio, Naomi Pomeroy, he's James Beard award-winning chef in Portland, Oregon. Will Guerre from 11 Mass, former 11 Mass in Park. Kevin Boehm from Boca in Chicago. A lot of leading figures in our culinary scene. You know, there's about 80 people on the call. We have 3 calls a week, and it's a great resource for people who want to get involved.
You know, I'm so thankful that you joined us for this inaugural of what I hope to be a, you know, sort of a long running podcast. Are there any final things or summation that you would say to someone who is out there who was battling, whether they're in the restaurant community, which obviously is rife with drug addiction, it's, you know, it's very cliche, or just someone in general, or any parting advice you could give to someone to sort of help them on their journey to find peace and tranquility and headspace, especially in these times? You know, I'd love to sort of hear those final, that final bit of Gregory wisdom.
I think for me, what I've learned is that it's extremely important to know what you want and be able to define who you are. You know, as humans, you know, we are constantly changing, constantly evolving. We should be always growing. But knowing what you want in life and knowing what you're good at, you know, are the two most important things in kind of helping you define your path. And, you know, here I am in my mid-40s, and I feel like my path is still changing. You know, I have a very clear vision of who I am. You know, that changes quite often. I have a very clear vision of what I want to do. That changes quite often, you know, but for all the things that I desire, you know, I just put one foot forward and keep moving forward. You know, I talk to a lot of people who are kind of trying to define their identity and struggle with, they have a wife and they have a child and, you know, they own a restaurant and, you know, they're still trying to make balance and seek happiness. But, you know, one of my yoga instructors once told me, you know, the most important thing in your life is you. And that just means, you know, if you're not in the best place for yourself, then you can't be the best person for the rest of the world. So if you're constantly pursuing what you want and making sure that your dreams, you know, are clear, and you're putting in the work to achieve those dreams, and maybe they're personal goals, maybe they're goals for your family, understanding your self-worth so you can be smart with business, if you're your own business or if you're employed by someone, you know, all these things, all these value, metrics of value, they're all important as well. So, you know, just finding confidence and staying humble, you know, are really important things. But, you know, if you're unhappy in a situation, I think it's really important to get out of that situation. And I think not being scared of change is really, really important, because, you know, I had to make some really, really big changes when I got sober, and it took me quite some time to come to those realizations. But when I was able to let myself free of all the things holding me back, my life completely changed, you know, and now I don't look back at all. And when I do, I look back as, you know, a learning experience that is kind of helping shape my future. So
I think that's a great way to end. I, in sort of trying to pull things together, took some quotes down from Winston Churchill, who is someone I will read about literally anything that comes out, see any film with him. And he has some of the more memorable quotes, and you just sort of nailed two of them. And I'll give them as sort of my parting piece. The first quote is, "Fear is a reaction to change. Courage is a decision." And the second is, "Success consists of going from failure to failure without a loss of enthusiasm." And Gregory, I think you have embodied both of those things, especially once you made the decision to get sober, more so than anyone I know. And it has been amazing to watch. I cannot wait to see what happens next. I use you as an inspiration because consistently I want to not put myself out there. I want to stay small for no other reason than to stay safe. And I know that trying to stay safe is nothing other than a way to stay small. And, you know, I always do think of you, and I really appreciate so much you doing this first podcast. And I look forward to continuing the journey and the friendship. And thank you for being Uncle Gigi to the kids. And thank you for this season of Top Chef, because
of course,
boy, are we ever having fun watching and rooting for you and making the phone calls after we watch it the day after, because it's on too late for the kids. The kids can't wait to hear your voice. Gregory, I love you. I'm so happy you're part of my life. And thank you so much for taking part of this. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much, Warner. Thank you for having me. It was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Creating Home. While we all face this new and uncertain world, I find it inspirational and reassuring to learn of our guests' journeys from around the country. And I hope you do too. Join us next week as we continue to learn what goes into creating home.